Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. We're Paul Dibb makes a welcome appearance at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of Inside the Wilderness of Mirrors, Australia and the Threat from the Soviet Union in the Cold War and Russia Today. Now, Paul Dibb is a very well-known figure. I'll introduce him briefly. Emeritus Professor of Strategic Studies at the Australian National University's Strategic and Defence Studies Centre in Canberra. He wrote the 1986 Review of Australia's Defence Capabilities. It was called the Dibb Report and was the primary author of the 1987 Defence White Paper. His career in Australia has been as a prominent academic, a senior policymaker, an intelligence official, and it spanned almost half a century. He's also the author of some six books. And tonight, Professor Dibb's going to talk to us on the topic of Australia, the Soviet Union, and the Cold War, and Russia today. Paul Dibb, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerard, and thank you for the invite. First of all, I'd like to explain the reason for this book. It's part autobiography, which made me very nervous because I, as Gerard would know, never write about myself. That's what intelligence officers don't do. But I got fed up with we run a master's degree program of about 70 students, strategic and defense studies. Most of them are in their mid to late 20s to early 30s with some mature age students. And I got fed up with questions like, Professor Dibb, is there a good book on this Soviet Union place? And I can see, looking round the audience, most of us lived through the persistent threat of global nuclear war, didn't we? And that's now been forgotten. Nuclear weapons are scarcely discussed, let alone their destructive capability. At the height of its power, the Soviet Union had 12,000 strategic nuclear weapons. And to give you an idea of the destructive effect, the latest unclassified British cabinet minutes, which were top secret code word, said that in the 1960s, 10 1-megaton Soviet warheads would have obliterated England as a modern functioning society. It would have reverted to barbarism, looting, robbing, and the military in control. And radioactivity would have meant most people would have had serious illnesses, let alone the capacity to have children. Well, today, the good news is Russia only has 5,000 strategic nuclear warheads, plus several thousand theatre nuclear weapons and tactical nuclear weapons. As Jim Mattis, the Secretary of the US Department of Defence, has said in the latest annual report in January this year, Russia is the only country capable of eliminating the United States with nuclear weapons. China cannot do that. China could create some mischief, serious mischief, but it is not able to completely wipe out a country like America. America, by the way, is capable of wiping out China if you think losing 400 to 500 million in an exchange is a definition of destroying effectively the population and economic base of a country. The other reason for writing it was as head of the National Assessment Staff when I was 34, which was the staff writing all the National Intelligence Assessments for the National Intelligence Committee, and then later on Director of the Defence Intelligence Organisation, and then at the very tail end of the Cold War, Deputy Secretary of Defence for Intelligence and Strategic Policy, with a rank the same as the service chiefs. Again, I got fed up of people saying, and not just students, Australia didn't do much in the Cold War with the Soviet Union. We weren't a member of NATO. We weren't in the Fulda Gap facing 300 Soviet divisions, as the NATO countries were. The Russians, the Soviets, the nearest they got to us in terms of military capacity was at Kamran Bay, and we had that operation of theirs under still highly classified continuous submarine surveillance. They didn't get any closer than that. But as I'm going to explain to you, we operated with the Americans the joint intelligence collection facilities at Pine Gap, near Alice Springs, Narunga, near Woomera, Northwest Cape, near Exmouth. And to this day, very few people hold the Pine Gap clearance. I held it for 20 years, including Jared, 10 years as Professor Dibb. Okay. There's four or five things I want to quickly address. One is ASIO. I worked for ASIO covertly for 20 years as a counter-espionage agent trying to infiltrate the Soviet embassy. And the question I want to very briefly address for you is, was there a Soviet spy in ASIO? And was ASIO successfully infiltrated, as MI6 with Kim Philby was, and others, Burgess, MacLean, all private school Cambridge graduates, which as the son of a Yorkshire coal miner more than amuses me. Secondly, what was the key secret role of Pine Gap? And I've got a chapter on Pine Gap and the joint facilities, which I haven't cleared with the Department of Defense or anybody else. Things that are 40 years old, with rare exceptions, can be talked about. You can't talk detailed operational questions, but the Americans have put huge amounts of stuff in the public domain about Pine Gap, which in Australia we don't do. So our American ally reveals secrets about itself and we shut up, and there's something wrong there. Don't get me wrong, I'm not arguing for total transparency. When you've worked in the game, there are still things that can, if exposed, can do enormous damage to your national security. Third, I want to explain to you that the Cuban Missile Crisis was not the nearest we got to global nuclear war. It was 1983, and I'll explain the reasons why. And again, there's a chapter in the book. They're all going to have to buy this book, aren't they, James? Fourth, why did we get the collapse and disintegration of the Soviet Union so badly wrong? And, you know, to the very end, the Americans still were saying to Ronald Reagan when he was at Reykjavik, and Gorbachev was trying to dramatically reduce nuclear weapons, the angels of death who were advising Reagan, whispering in his ear, was, this is all a put-up job. Well, look, when you worked with the Soviets, as I did for 20-odd years, yeah, you had to be highly suspicious. They were a nasty group. Gorbachev changed all that. He was a different man. He knew the Soviet economy was busted. Fifth and finally, is Russia today a serious threat, including for Australia? And the answer is yes. And if I get a moment, I want to raise what Dennis Richardson, who most of you know or know of, who launched my book at the ANU in June, has raised with me, and that is, what are the parallels that we need to learn methodologically in terms of analysis of getting the Soviet Union wrong, and now we're doing the same with China, kidding ourselves that China has no problems. China has plenty of problems. Okay. I'd been in Australia 3.5 years when I made my first visit to the Soviet embassy. I was working as an economist for a bloke called Stuart Harris, who Gerard remembers, who was later Secretary of Foreign Affairs. I was working in the Bureau of Agricultural Economics. I wasn't in the spook game. And I was writing for Blackjack McEwen a report on the economics of the Soviet wheat industry, because the Brits, my pommy mates, were joining the common market. We were going to lose big markets. And I spoke and read enough Russian, not fluently, certainly to read the Soviet statistical yearbook, which told me what the acreage sown was, what it was winter wheat, what was spring wheat. There wasn't such a copy in the National Library of Australia. There was not such a copy in the ANU's Chifley Library. So I said to my boss, do you think I should go and knock on the door? So I did. And I got the statistical yearbook, which I still have. And within an hour of getting back, my boss said, come back in, Dib, you're in deep trouble. The spooks want to see you. If you know the Soviet embassy, which is still, only just still there in Canberra Avenue near Manuka, ASIO occupied the top floor of Tobin Brothers' funeral parlour. More importantly, next door to that was the Kingston pub. So within a few weeks, I met Ron Richards, who was that time the deputy to Brigadier Spry of running ASIO. Ron Richards was a man who encouraged Petrov and his wife, Evdokia Petrova, to defect. And you can imagine this stuck in my mind. It was in what's called a safe house in Manuka, and Ron Richards said to me, we think, Paul, that you might have a career that will give you good access. Will you work for us? We want to know what the Soviet embassy priorities are, what they think about Australia and America. Are they interested in Pine Gap and satellite photography? As individuals, what are their strengths and weaknesses, including their drinking habits, how they drive a car, relations with women, so on. And I said, yes, that sounds rather exciting, but I want my career protected. Once you're in the wilderness of mirrors, which I'm about to explain, there's always a risk, because you're getting close to these forbidden people, that you'll be seen as one of them. The wilderness of mirrors was coined up by a person I only met once, the CIA's head of Soviet counter-espionage throughout the 60s and 70s. He had a great name, as only the Americans do, James Jesus Angleton. He grew orchids, by the way, and he loved T.S. Eliot, the poet. And he believed that everybody was a traitor, including in CIA. And to understand why, you've got to understand it was Kim Philby who was sent by MI6 to help establish CIA. And I know I shouldn't laugh, but, you know, and the damage that Philby did. And as a result, James Jesus Angleton saw every Russian as a threat, including ones who defected and had valuable information about the split between the Soviet Union and China. He had them tortured because they were lying. So James Jesus Angleton took this poem of T.S. Eliot's about the wilderness of mirrors. As you walk down the wilderness of mirrors, you see your own reflection and everybody else's reflection, and nothing is trustworthy. Nothing. And, you know, we all get in this game against the Soviet Union, the intelligence game, it was a consistent problem. Quickly, do I think there was a Soviet spy in ASIO? Yes. My best friend, Donald Ralph Marshall, he was exactly my age. He ran me for 10 years. His father had done the Russian language translation of the Petrov documents. He used to tell me that time after time, ASIO operations against the Soviet embassy failed. Now, you know, there'll be some views about ASIO. You know, they're not MI6 and so on, but they weren't stupid. They'd got big training in MI6 and in CIA. They had no luck penetrating the Soviet embassy, other than the fact I wrote about 54 reports for them in a matter of a few years. Who was it? The rumour mill is still hot, despite the release of the official history of ASIO. A certain former very senior person's name was kicked around, and I'm not going to mention it because the evidence in the end wasn't there. They got some minor person who was taking classified stuff home, and I think he did some damage. But the proof that there was a Soviet spy is CIA told us a few years ago, more than a decade, that the KGB resident Lazovic had been given a medal for his operations in Australia. The KGB resident I operated against most intensively, Lev Koshlyakov, who I met 2 years ago, by the way, in Moscow, and he admitted he was what he was. He was described in the ASIO history as the most dangerous KGB resident. I don't underestimate Lev Koshlyakov, but I think Lazovic was the one. Secondly, Pine Gap. Until recently, the only stuff that was published was by a colleague of mine, Des Ball, who, when I was in defence, I was forbidden to have a relationship with. He was a naughty boy, but he got stuff out of the American Congressional Records and, you know, Freedom of Information that was an order of magnitude close enough to the truth. So what the three facilities were Pine Gap, which is about 8 kilometres from Alice Springs, is America's most powerful intelligence collection operation anywhere in the world outside of America. The figures I can give you, as long ago as the late 1980s, was that bird, that satellite, was in geostationary orbit 32,000 kilometres out, pointing at the Soviet Union. And when it got into orbit at 32,000 kilometres, it opened an antenna 40 metres in diameter. Think about that. It monitored all Soviet ballistic missile launches. We intercepted the telemetry. We had views about the lift operation of the rocket and therefore what type of warheads. And I've been careful. It intercepted lots of Russian military communications. It still does that against Russia, China, North Korea, some other places. It is an incredibly powerful operation. And people who think we should get rid of the ANZUS alliance, never mind we wouldn't have a defence force, because our kit is nearly all highly advanced American military equipment that the Americans only sell to us and the Brits, not to the Germans, not to the French, not to the Italians, not to the Japanese, none of those. This is Five Eyes stuff. And Pine Gap is the crown jewels, and that's why Whitlam nearly got us in severe trouble, as Gerard remembers, over the whole Pine Gap publicity. Woomera, the facility there, which has now been absorbed into Pine Gap, when I ran the policy on it, as I also ran policy when Beasley was minister on Pine Gap, Narunga, which is near Woomera, detects the infrared heat of missile launches. So it was able to tell the Americans that silo is now empty. Don't waste a shot on it. And we kidded ourselves that we were not part of American nuclear warfighting capability. And I convinced myself of that in talks that I went with a bloke called Bill Pritchard, who was later Secretary of Defense, when we spent in 1978, 5 working days in Washington seeing the director CIA, the director NSA, the director DIA, the deputy secretary of defense, the deputy secretary of state. As Gerard will know, that is real high level stuff, and you're on display. In 78, we convinced ourselves we were part of mutually assured destruction. The problem was there was a couple of traitors in America who had access to the Pine Gap information, worked for a company called TRW. And they gave this information, the Lee Boyce pair, to the Soviets. And the Soviets would have seen that from their point of view, if Australia could tell the Americans that that missile silo is empty, don't waste a shot. So you'll see in the book, I definitively argue, as I did at the time after 78, the more I knew what the Soviets had got access to, if I was a Soviet, by the way, as a good intelligence officer, you should be able to think as the opposition does. You need to know their history, their geography, their culture. It didn't for you to side with them, but I came to the view, if I was a Soviet, whilst Australia wouldn't be a prime nuclear target, America, Britain, Germany, Japan would be, when you've got 12,000 warheads, you've got a few to spare. Why wouldn't you take out Pine Gap, Narunga and Northwest Cape? And if you really wanted to damage Australia as America's closest ally in the entire Asia-Pacific, take out a place like this one. I did some calculations. And I forget the figures, they're in the book. 750,000 instant dead in Sydney and another 300,000-400,000 from massive radiation. There's a chapter in the book.
Would I be safe in Byron Bay?
Pardon?
Would I be safe in Byron Bay?
Okay.
You might be. you might be. And the question is, was Canberra one of them? And of course, the seat of power. Third, you remember I said that the Cuban Missile Crisis was not the most dangerous. It was dangerous enough. But the Soviets backed down. They're in an inferior position. In 1983, there's a chapter in the book about Able Archer. Able Archer was a NATO exercise. The Soviets were being run by a sick, very intelligent man called Andropov, former head of the KGB. He was convinced the Americans were developing the capacity for a sudden disarming first strike. By the way, how you do that with 12,000 missiles beats me, but whoops, just missed two. Bang goes, you know, Los Angeles and New York. The Soviets had deployed theater nuclear weapons called SS-20s, which were not intercontinental missiles and therefore not under the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, and they were capable of wiping out Germany, Britain, so on. The Americans deployed Pershing 2 into West Germany. It had a flight time to Moscow of 6 minutes, and its aim was to destroy the Soviet leadership. That's what the Soviets thought. That's what the Soviets thought. I won't bore you, it's in the book. There were lots of other things going on. The Korean airliner 007 with 300 people on board was shot down over Siberia. Exercise Able Archer was an annual exercise, but this time it changed the code words for nuclear missile release, simulated. And Andropov sent out an instruction to all KGB residents, including the Soviet one in London, Gordievsky, who later defected and who I met in Asia, that they had to look out for every signs that the Western allies were going on to short warning nuclear attack. Now, is there suddenly a run on blood banks? Are the windows on the fourth floor, which is, you know, the nuclear floor of the MOD in the UK, on late at night? I mean, we can laugh, but believe you me, I convinced myself and so have many others, and it becomes clearer as we get more and more information, that according to the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, which reviewed the CIA's performance, they dangerously got it wrong. They wrote reports, the CIA, the Soviet leadership does not believe or does not think, and as the President's Advisory Board says, but you had no agents inside the Kremlin, so how did you know? The answer was, they didn't. Gerard's read my book, which I wrote in 85, 86, called The Incomplete Superpower. Did not predict, I wasn't good enough to see the end of the Soviet Union. But it said this country, the Soviet Union, has serious economic, social, and indeed ideological weaknesses. I'd finished doing my Australian Defence Report for Minister for Defence Beazley, and I was the director of the Defence Intelligence Organisation. So I go to Langley, CIA headquarters, and one Robert Gates, whose name you may remember, yeah, he was deputy director of CIA. So in 1986, he says to me, Paul, we've read your book, The Incomplete Superpower. You are wrong. The Soviet Union is poised to outstrip America in military and economic power. 89, down goes the Berlin Wall. 91, I can't sing my favorite Beatles song, back in the USSR. Huh? Which brings me to the fourth point. Why did, at my rough estimate, 250,000 American intelligence officials, the whole of CIA, the whole of NSA, the Electronic Intercept Organization, facilities like Pine Gap, Narunga, dotted around the world, why did they get it wrong? And my crude answer, which you may well challenge, is groupthink. And you don't express a different point of view in Washington in the late 80s. Even though Blind Freddy could see, there was something really wrong. It wasn't to say that the Soviets weren't still powerful. They were. Till the dying day of the Soviet Union, there was still a risk that the Soviet military and the KGB would have overpowered Gorbachev and used the weapon systems that I've mentioned to defend the Soviet motherland. And it's still a puzzle why they didn't. Don't get me wrong, the Soviet Union was an enormously difficult target. Sure, from overhead photography, which by the way, we in Canberra, satellite photography, got from 1964, which was in my organisation, and it got more and more powerful. You could literally not read number plates of cars, that's a myth, but you could see individuals walking around near the ballistic missile sites and so on. Therefore, you could see lots of other things. The intercept organisations like NSA and, in a different way, DSD here in Canberra, and other things meant that we had good technical information on the military, on their missiles, on their nuclear explosions, on the armour plate, on their tanks and so on. The Soviets produced little in the way of economic statistics, and most of them were absolutely a waste of time. They lied for the Communist Party. You know, and we think that happens in China, by the way. We knew that the ideological control was an iron fist. But when you heard Russian jokes like, you know, you go into a restaurant and they show you the menu and they say, that's off, that's not available, that's not available, and you see in a flash restaurant, waiters are like this with a napkin looking at you. And the joke was, they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work. And there was numbers of those sorts of statements which told you the cynicism. They weren't about to rise up, but they were dragging their feet. Even so, they made first-rate military equipment. And by the way, they still do. They're better than the Chinese right now. Fifth, is Russia today a serious threat? Yes, and the book has a long chapter on that, which brings it right up to date. So this book represents half a century of my life in Australia. Why is it a threat? I believe, and again you may well want to challenge this, most countries are prisoners of their history, their geography and their culture. That includes us, in a different way. As Russian history was developing with the proclamation of Christianity in Ukraine over 1,000 years ago, there was the elements of, not democracy, but of the nobles in a particular city called Novgorod, Gospodin Veliki Novgorod, His Highness the Great Novgorod, voting. But very quickly, Russia was occupied for 250 years by the Mongol horde that taught them vicious, nasty cruelty. 250 years, Jared, is that longer than America's been a separate country? Can you do a quick one?
About the same.
About the same? Stephen? Yeah.
About the same.
Yeah. 250 years, violent, nasty occupation. At the same time, they were being attacked by the Teutonic Knights, the Germans. You all know the history. Sweden, in the late 1700s, got deep into Ukraine before the Russians defeated them. Napoleon, you know how that ended up, and Hitler's Germany, which still figures hugely in Putin's Russia. Because he can't boast about the Soviet Union as a superpower. It's not a superpower. It's a regional power except for its nuclear weapons. And if you watch the May Day, the May marches for the Great Patriotic War, you'll see how he plays that one like a violin, with Xi Jinping next to him. And by the way, year before last, Netanyahu next to him, which is an interesting thing. Michael probably will have a view on that. Its geography, from a defence planner's point of view, is vulnerable. We Anglo-Saxons, who've grown up in countries like the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and America, effectively are island countries. I mean, don't tell them that Mexico and Canada are an issue. We have no common borders. Right now, the nearest NATO F-16 airfield in Estonia, and I'm not being critical of the Baltic countries, I'm stating the fact, the nearest NATO airfield from St. Petersburg, and I can't do a Sydney example, it's Canberra to Coomber, with the border going through Bredburn. As a former defence planner, if right now we had Indonesian Sukhoi fighters in Coomber, we would be doing something about it, given our paranoia. Putin, I mean, my dear colleague, who's wrong on other things, Hugh White, says to me, why do you study Russia, Paul? It's finished, waste of time. Its economy is about the same size as Australia's, with 5 times the population. Well, I got news for you. You know, he goes into Georgia and stares the Americans down. He goes into Crimea and stares NATO down. He's still in eastern Ukraine and ain't giving up. And he's in Syria and he's displacing the Americans. Yes? Yes. And he's using advanced weapon systems, including out of the Caspian Sea, cruise missiles and submarine launched ones. Putin wants to be recognised as a great power. And if you'll forgive me saying so, at the dreadful Helsinki summit, you could see the smirk on his face as President Trump put his foot right in it. I won't tell you what the word Trump means in the Yorkshire dialect, but if somebody asks me the question, I might. Russia is not in our part of the world. In that sense, it does not pose the same threat as China, which does pose a threat. But listen to the following that Russia's doing. It's supplying small arms and rifles and mortars to Fiji. They didn't do that in the Cold War. They didn't have a presence in the South Pacific. In the G20, you'll recall, when Tony Abbott wanted to shirt front Putin over the shooting down of MH17, which was a dreadful barbaric thing. You remember, Putin's there, sat by himself in Brisbane, and two of his major warships come down from Vladivostok, the Veryag and the Marshal Kapushnikov. Our brilliant reporter said, oh, pathetic, out-of-date Russian ships. Oh, really? They've just been completely modernised and they carried tactical nuclear weapons. And what do you think we carry? Pop guns. This last December, unlike in the Cold War, two long-range Russian Tu-95 strategic bombers landed at Biak in Indonesian Irian Jaya and did an 8-hour navigation patrol in the South Pacific. So don't tell me there isn't an issue. There is. Very quickly, Russia's main focus is Europe. Putin is happy that he can see Europe tearing itself apart. My pommy mates getting out of EU, some of which I understand. My part of England voted 78% to get out, by the way, the coal miners and the steel workers. He's delighted that Trump describes the EU as a foe and an enemy, and that you NATO people are lazy, and rightly says you should spend more on defence, but it's the way he does it that's bad. All that is to the advantage of Putin. Next week, this waste of time country called Russia is going to mount a nationwide exercise called Vostok, which means the East. Week after next, it'll have 300,000 troops. And 3,500 Chinese ones, so the Chinese can learn. Putin can put 80,000 troops under the guise of that exercise into any of what's called the near abroad. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Georgia, there, all those lot. And what is NATO going to do if he decides to march into the capital of Estonia, Tallinn, which is about the distance from Canberra to Mittagong? And is NATO actually going to go to war with Russia, including are the Germans going to go to war with Russia? And what will Australia do? We're a strategic partner of NATO, we're not a member, but are we actually going to see a democratic, independent Baltic country invaded? And ask me if I think my government, and I'm not fingering the Turnbull-Morrison government, I'm not a member of any party and never have been, we just sit there and wring our hands. Final few words, because I'm over time. When Dennis Richardson, you know, who ran ASIO, was ambassador to the United States, Secretary of Foreign Affairs and Defence, I chose him for obvious reasons to launch this book. He had read it thoroughly and he said, Paul, a lot of the things you're saying in the book about today's Russia and the lessons we should learn about the mistakes about the Soviet Union and the vulnerabilities of Russia, we should be saying about China. Very quickly. China is an ageing population. It'll get old before it gets rich. Already, its workforce is declining in numbers and there's nothing they can do about it. They will have a massive public welfare and health and pension problem. They've got pollution problems And you don't have to be, you know, a climate change person to understand the pollution in China is dreadful. They have problems of severe corruption. Their military have not fought a modern war, whereas America has fought non-stop since 9/11, 2001, as indeed we have. The last so-called modern war the Chinese were in was in 1979. I was in the intel game. We had the call signs of their four divisions. We had the call sign of the North Vietnamese division, which was a battle-hardened division, and it was a draw. They have not shown they can operate in joint military operations. Their deep water anti-submarine warfare is poor. Their submarines make as much noise as early 1983 submarines, including the Chinese ballistic missile submarines. Their air defences are purely Russian. And they still import high-performance military jet engines from Russia because they've been able to make them. I'm not arguing that China is not making advances. It is. But as Dennis says, we need a study done in Canberra, of which I see no evidence. What are the weaknesses of China, as well as its strengths? How can we exploit weaknesses? And can we come to some definition that we've gone, this is a question, that we've gone too far in our economic dependence on China? You know, a third of our exports, 60% of our iron ore. The leading numbers of tourists and students. Should we draw a line? Now, you know, the economists here will tell us that might cost us. Well, when it's getting to this national security issue, we may have to do that. My final words are these. And three of my colleagues are about to make a major ANU public speech on this, entitled Why Australia Needs a Radically New Defence Policy. And I'll be called an old Cold War warrior, I know. In the mid-80s, under successive governments, in the 76 White Paper, the Fraser government later, the Beazley one and so on, short of global nuclear war, the only country with the conventional military capabilities to threaten Australia, in a very modest way, was Indonesia. And it had a lot of Soviet weapons. That's why we bought the F-111s, whose previously classified range was Darwin to Jakarta and back, and refueled. That's when we bought the Oberon submarines. Ditto. Now, this talk that my colleagues and I are going to give this month, why do we need a radically new defence policy? Because we now have a country increasingly in our neighbourhood that is a major power with whom we do not share values, that is capable of mounting high-intensity military conflict and operations in our region and maybe against us. They have the military capabilities. So all that has to change is the intention. I'm not saying China's about to do that. There's good reasons why China doesn't want a war, including economically. But as defence planners, we cannot ignore this. And so I should finish there. I just wanted to draw the parallels, however, of we made these big mistakes on the Soviet analytical model. In a different way, are we doing it on China? Thank you.
Many thanks to Professor Dibb. As I said, the book, Inside the Wilderness of Mirrors, Australia and the Threat from the Soviet Union and the Cold War and Russia Today, if you would get in, leave notes with us, we can get the book to you, and it's available from Melbourne University Press direct. You can go on their website and get it through there as well. And so we come to the question discussion. Thanks for finishing on time. So we have a lot of time. Your book that you referred to in the 1980s, which depicted the Soviet Union as an incomplete power, obviously from what you're saying tonight, you didn't think it was an incomplete military power. You thought it was a very substantial military power, but you thought it was a weak society and a weak economy. Mm. Now, what would you say about China? What you seem to be saying about China is that it's got its social and economic and population problems, but you also seem to be saying that it's not like the military power that the Soviet Union was in the mid-80s. So, I know you've covered this a bit at the end, but what you seem to be saying is that the Chinese army, unlike the Chinese army, has never really been tested. Mm. So, how strong is that? How does it compare with the Soviet Union that you wrote about 30 years ago?
Yeah. I mean, partly the Soviets also although they were strong militarily, and, you know, the Americans were more than a bit frightened on occasions. If push ever came to shove, at the time of the Cold War, the Soviets had to fight America, Britain and NATO, and most likely China. So, you know, two-front war, massive targeting and battle problems. And they became obsessed by it. I think with China, Jared, their economy is certainly stronger than the Soviet Union was. But the economists here would know that it's an economy that has some very high-intensity problems. The debt, the price of housing, the problems of sustaining these high rates of growth in this devil's pact that the Chinese communists have with the population, and that is, we'll let you earn lots of money, and if you want to own a Rolls Royce or a Ferrari and be a billionaire, you can do that. And if you're an ordinary middle class person, as we see every day in Sydney, you can go overseas, wherever you like. What is the impact of these people coming to places like Sydney, and indeed to my farm at Robertson, where we had a Chinese willing worker, who quizzed me about freedom and democracy, and quizzed me about Xi Jinping, and said to my wife, I hear that Paul was on FM radio, national radio, and said that Julie Bishop was complacent. Isn't he in jail? Not yet. You know, what is the impact? But the devil's pact is, but you will not criticize the Communist Party of China. It is the natural ruling party. Last Friday, we had a bunch of Chinese generals and what's called senior colonels, brigadiers, at the ANU. And we asked them about totalitarianism and so on. Well, you know, and it was a very clever argument. You know, in our long history, unlike yours, we've not had the Industrial Revolution and the Reformation, you know. And in any case, we have the Communist Party and other parties. Well, that's news to me, you know. And as to authoritarian leaders and president for life, what about Angela Merkel? What about, which Roosevelt was it that was in for four terms?
FDR.
Yeah. They raised that one, Stephen. Now, clever stuff. But you just wonder about this devil's pact of a middle class, you know, was it 200-300 million people? It'll be 500-600 million people going overseas. Our worker on the farm at Robertson this last January, she's been to Japan, she's been to Taiwan. I said, have you been to the 8-story bookshop? Oh yes, she said, which is open 24 hours a day by the edict of the Taiwanese government. All the Chinese tourists go in, buy books they are not allowed to read, go back to their hotel, lock the door and get room service and read. Now, it's a non-trivial point, frankly. And I'm getting sick. I know I'm named by certain commentators on China as being part of, you know, the national security push. Well, yes, so that's what I'm paid to do. But what worries me about some of our China economic experts, no names, no pectoral, is when they write things, including for the Fin Review and in an ANU publication called the East Asia Forum, they never once mention the role of the Communist Party and values. And we will not share values with China. And that naturally puts a limit on the relationship. Final point, by the way, and it's an ominous point. When these members of the Soviet Red Army swore their oath of allegiance, it was to defend the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the motherland. When the PLA swore their oath of allegiance, it is to defend and keep the Communist Party of China in power.
Now, there are a lot of people here, so you've got to be brief with your questions or comments.
Thank you, Jared. Stephen, Lucy from ASPI, congratulations on the book, Paul. Two brief questions. In terms of the evolution of Russian intelligence services, the KGB used to have both external and domestic obligations. That's now been divided between the SVR and the FSB, which appears to have seen the GRU, military intelligence, come into its own in terms of external probing, external intelligence gathering. I'd be interested in your comment on that, and also in terms of the Baltic states and Poland. A Russian military intrusion would not only be fighting the locals, but as you're aware, there are US, British, French, and Canadian troops there as a tripwire, precisely to deter that. And so I think in that circumstance, perhaps NATO would be obliged to defend the Baltics and Poland from the very first shot.
The issue of the GRU, the Soviet-era military intelligence, it still keeps that acronym. If you're asking me, which I think you are, Stephen, did I think that what happened in Salisbury and the use of this highly dangerous nerve agent, Novichok — Novichok means the newcomer on the block in a rather nasty way, and it's only made in Russia, as far as we know. It does not bear the hallmarks that the professional KGB would have. They would have not left a container with line around so somebody could spray it and think it was perfume. They weren't that stupid. Do I think, and I have no evidence, this is supposition, Skripal worked for the GRU. Before that, he was in the commandos in Afghanistan. Then he joined the GRU, and for 9 years he betrayed to MI6 operatives in Moscow the names and locations of all Russian GRU agents in Europe. And probably a number of those were subject to extreme administrative methods, as the KGB used to say. When, remember that woman Chapman, whatever her first name was, with the 9-10 Russian spies in America, what were called stay behind, so when global war occurs, you leave people behind to... You might ask me if there are certain Russians in this country that might be in that role. That, as far as Putin was concerned, when Chapman and the 10 or 11 came back and were exchanged in Vienna, he held a big boozy vodka party for them in Moscow, and he said, Putin, the one thing I will not tolerate at any price is disloyalty to the motherland. Those who are traitors will find that I kicked the can down the road. Now, if you were a GRU operative, you'd say, OK, I've got the benediction. I mean, it doesn't mean to say that they went to see him. They could well have taken matters into their own hands. They're a powerful organisation. And, you know, as I say, the MO, the modus operandi, to me, does not look like the SVR. I could be wrong. Little criticism of MI6, by the way. Why wasn't Skripal in a safe house under a different name, as we did for Petrov from 1950, when was it, 54, until they died? And part of the answer is that it was an unwritten rule in the Cold War that when you exchange spies, you would not go after them. Well, that little rule has just died, with all the implications of that.
Now, the one at the
Baltics. No, sorry.
Okay. Now, the one with the microphone's got the call, so there's up there. Okay.
Professor, a quick two-parter. Firstly, what does Trump mean in Yorkshire Dale?
What does he mean, what?
In Yorkshire Dale.
In Yorkshire Dale.
Second, you don't have a need to know.
And second, do you have a view on the insights on Russian collusion?
Yeah. Trump in the Yorkshire dialect means to, I'll be polite,
open the microphone,
means to break wind. It's a great one, isn't it? It really applies. What was the second one? Yeah. Look, again, I don't have inside information these days, but do we actually think that before he was president, Trump, who had been bankrupt 3 times, on his visits to Russia, might not have been tempted? He's attracted to attractive women. I'm not saying there's any evidence. I'm not saying there's any evidence at all. But if Putin has evidence, whatever they discuss in these one-on-ones, and it's okay for Trump to say, when he said, I believe Trump on the lack of collusion in the elections. Then remember, he hastened back to Washington. And do any of us in this room think that Trump actually understood what a double negative was?
No.
Hands up, come on. No. But we've got to live with this president. It is not the end of ANZUS. There are people here at the back of the audience who know this. Remember I said earlier, we have weapon systems that only are shared with the Americans. The combat system on the Collins submarine is the Virginia-class combat system. It's American weapon systems. Ditto the Super Hornets and the JSF. Ditto the Aegis combat operations on the AWDs, air warfare destroyers, and the frigates. And most powerfully, the 10 Growler electronic warfare aircraft are powerful enough to suppress enemy air defences. We are the only other country in the world to have this. So, you know, some of my colleagues who are now talking about it's time to get out of ANZUS, well, what sort of defence force would we have? It would look like New Zealand. Quickly on the Baltics, yeah, you make good points there, Stephen. My worry is, yes, there are four deployed battalions of Canadians and Brits and Poles. What do they do when 30 divisions overrun them? And as Europe, if you're Putin, would you actually believe that NATO has got the backbone? I think the Poles probably do, but the Russians would take care of that, but I could be wrong. Sorry.
Michael.
Professor Dib, great to see you again. If I was an Estonian, I would be very concerned about the Russians in Kaliningrad and across the border.
Yeah.
But if I was a Taiwanese, I'd be even more concerned about the PLA and the PLN across the straits.
Yes.
In 1979, President Clinton put two American aircraft carrier battle groups in the Taiwan Straits to deter the Chinese end. The problem is we've changed. We've got a president, I don't believe, in such circumstances that the Americans would do the same. And I actually can't understand why the aggressive military faction in China hasn't moved already, a la Crimea, against the Taiwanese.
Now, look, it's a good question, and that's something I'm supposed to be in Taiwan later this year, but can't make it for all sorts of reasons. I've been there three times now. As an official, I could not go to Taiwan, and I'm ashamed of that. When you go there, as you know, Michael, this is a vibrant democracy of 24 million, the size of Australia on an island the size of Tasmania. It was under military occupation and rule, and they overthrew that. They now have a museum, which the Minister for Culture took me to 2 years ago in Taipei, which shows how Chiang Kai-shek had people tortured because they were communist. And when the kangaroo courts said with one particular person, 20 years in jail, in his own handwriting, according to a fluent Chinese English speaker with me, Chiang Kai-shek wrote, no, execute. When you have that confidence in your system, it tells you that your democracy is vibrant and well-established. Remember, they had the students a few years ago occupying the parliament in the Sunflower Movement. So your question is a very pertinent and current one, as indeed is the Baltic one. These are democracies. Are we going to stand by and fold our arms when and if the Chinese decide to invade Taiwan? They can't use a big amphibious assault because they ain't got there yet, but God knows they've got enough missiles and they could choke off supplies. And I think you're right with Trump. There is a real risk that, you know, America First comes into operation and he ducks for cover. And I have warned the American visitors, including officials in Canberra, you let Taiwanese democracy go to the wall, and what do you think Japan and South Korea are going to do? Well, the answer is they would go for nuclear weapons. Mm. And what implications would it have for us? A lot.
Now, we're running out of time. I can't handle everyone. The person there, hang on, before you start, you've got to be very brief, then we finish with Zev. Okay.
Professor, our former Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, recently said that one of the things she was most proud about in her time as Foreign Minister was the work she was doing to try and get justice for the MH17 victims. How effective do you think she was, and what are the chances that justice will be able to be to be got for those people?
Yeah. When that incident occurred, it was a Friday Australian time, and the next 24 hours I did 15 TV and radio interviews, 15 TV and radio interviews, and asked me what a grateful Australian National University thinks about one of their professors doing that. I felt I had to do it for the Australian victims and their families. There's a particular Sydney family, which I will not give you their name, They lost their 19-year-old son. They're devastated. They came to see me a few months after that happened. That heard me on TV or radio. And I was able to say to them, look, I will give you as much technical information as I have access to. And, you know, I mean, I still get information in. I've lived in Canberra 56 years. We're part of the permanent government in Canberra. Didn't mean that, joking.
The deep state, eh?
Yeah, thank you. I said to them, this was a book 11, B-U-K, which means birch tree. Birch tree? Something like that. It carries a 750-kilogram warhead. It goes to Mach 5, five times the speed of sound. When it gets near to the aeroplane, it explodes in front of the aeroplane and it peppers the aeroplane with tens of thousands of pellets. If it had been a Ukrainian-Russian fighter with an air-to-air heat-seeking missile, it would take one of the engines out. So the Russians once again are lying, as they did, by the way, in 83 when the Korean line was brought down. Exactly the same. You can imagine these people are really distraught. She actually went and knocked on the door of the Soviet embassy and demanded to see the ambassador and got an audience. And of course he lied himself, silly, but I admired her. I think Julie is one of the best foreign ministers we've had. It's true that she's very tactical. My wife is a lawyer. Julie carries a brief very well. I've been as close to her as you are when she's launched the foreign policy white paper. I think, like most politicians these days of both persuasions, there's hardly a strategic thinker amongst them. But that's not to criticise what Julie's tried to do about that operation. And there's no doubt in my mind at all. Whether it was a mistake, I mean, that system, it has its own radar, it has its what's called transporter erector. You've seen the video. It came across the border east of Lugansk in Ukraine. It had four missiles, and when it came back into Russia, it had three missiles. Whether they thought it was a Ukrainian thing, I don't know. But either way, it was uncivilized. And there is a question of why Malaysian Airlines were flying over Ukraine when, as I understand it, Qantas and BA were not.
Professor Deep, you mentioned the Vostok exercises happening, I think, next week. For the, I think, first time Chinese will be part of it. What do you think, how long this good relationship between China and Russia would last?
Good question. Вы говорите по-русски?
Что не будь.
Я только говорю по-русски, когда я пью водку. I only speak Russian when I drink vodka. There's a very good book by former Australian diplomat, Australian-born Chinese, Bob Olo, L-O, was in our embassy. He now is with Chatham House in London. He's written a book, and I've forgotten the title, but I will email it to Jared for you. He says, it's deep in the Russian culture that when you're sat in Moscow and Vladivostok is three times of the distance away from Sydney to Perth, you've got a geopolitical problem. And there's only 6 million people live in the Russian Far East. It's declined rapidly since communism. It's a crap climate. It's very difficult. And across the border, there's 180 million Chinese immediately across in Heilongjiang province. Bobolo says that Russia will always be the junior partner. The Chinese economy is so much bigger, so much more vibrant, and China's power is growing daily. Now, they're members of this, you know, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is a laugh a minute. You know, China, Russia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and a bunch of others. It isn't the ASEAN Regional Forum or APEC. I think it suits Xi Jinping very much to have this relationship. They're two authoritarian anti-Western societies. But in the long run, Bob Olo argues, and I agree, the chickens will come home to roost geopolitically. I just mentioned, you know, from time to time during this talk, we need to accept in Australia we've got two authoritarian countries on the move, a Russia that's using military force but is distant from us, a China that's using direct coercion in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, and is trespassing into our strategic space in Southeast Asia and the South Pacific. And this final sentence is not deliberately aimed at Australia. And we have a West in crisis. America, Britain, Germany, far right-wing fascist parties in Germany, Poland, Hungary. Hmm? Bad news.
Many thanks, Paul, Deb. Look, I'm sorry, there are many more questions and comments here tonight. We just couldn't take them all on board. We're right on time, and we always finish on time. Now, I'm going to play my part here. I was going to thank the speaker in Russian, but I've decided that I shouldn't sort of flash my language skills. It would be a bit bragging. So I'm going to do it in English, and I'll do the Russian bit later on.
Self-effacing like me.
Look, many thanks, Paul Dib, for a wonderful book and a talk tonight on the book Inside the Wilderness of Mirrors, which we can help you buy later on. Firstly, I should say congratulations on a wonderful half-century career in Australia with a very important contribution to Australian society for which we all should be grateful. And I'm pleased that you've gone to write a book not merely about the big issues of the day, which you've done in the past, but also semi-biographical, autobiographical, and that's very important. You're in the book, and you should be in the book. And for tonight, thank you and well done.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.